Hello, this is your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, bringing you the September 22nd edition of The New Yorker magazine. Today's main story is how Jessica Reed Krause went from mommy blogger to Maha Maven by Claire Malone. Profiles: How Jessica Reed Krause went from mommy blogger to Maha Maven. The founder of House and Habit has grown her audience during the second Trump administration with political gossip and what she calls quality conspiracy, by Claire Malone. In mid-February, on the day that the Senate confirmed Robert F. Kennedy Jr. as Secretary of Health and Human Services, Del Bigtree, an anti-vaccine activist who had served as the communications director of Kennedy's presidential campaign, hosted an event at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. Bigtree was now the CEO of the advocacy group Maha Action and the National Press Club event, where members of the media gathered in a modest room with a small stage, was a celebration of sorts. The so-called Make America Healthy Again movement had just installed its figurehead as the most powerful public health official in the country. The Republican Senator Ron Johnson, a skeptic of the COVID vaccine and an early supporter of Kennedy's nomination, introduced Bigtree, calling him a man who has been engaged in radical transparency and as a result has been vilified and ridiculed. At the podium, Bigtree derided the assembled press. "You've been the spreaders of misinformation," he said. "You have gotten it wrong. And America is still waiting for an apology." Jessica Reed Krause, the 45-year-old writer behind the popular Instagram and Substack accounts House and Habit, was sitting on the floor a few feet away, live streaming Bigtree's speech. Her site, which grew out of a blog about motherhood and home decor, had become perhaps the most popular chronicler of Kennedy's rise, offering 500,000 Substack followers an inside look at the secretary's new life in the upper echelons of the American right. For the inauguration, she carpooled from the airport with Kennedy's daughter, Kira, and her post recapping that weekend Maha Ball struck a triumphant note. "I retreated to my table just behind Bobby and Cheryl, who arrived trailed by a sea of flashing lights," she wrote beneath a photo showing Kennedy in a tux and his wife, the actress Cheryl Hines, in form-fitting lamé. Their presence, poised and magnificent, felt uniquely symbolic, surrounded by a crowd maligned and mocked for their convictions. Krause, a recent convert to right-wing politics, she voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016, doesn't look like a MAGA conservative. A petite brunette with clear blue eyes, a pert nose, and an easy manner, she favors oversized shirts and menswear inspired suits. Before her year on the campaign trail, she told me she'd never worn a blazer. "I think the expectation to sort of match the occasion was hard for someone who lives in California and doesn't really wear makeup or shoes," she said. The first time I met her in person at a gala for New York's Young Republican Club, she wore a sleek suit with a bow tie and heels, drank a vodka martini, and called Nigel Farage cute. At the National Press Club, she had on a green plaid jacket with trousers and a pair of Jessica Simpson pumps, which she soon shucked off. At one point during Bigtree's speech, Callie Means, one of Kennedy's advisors, appeared. Krause crossed the room to give him a hug. She had previously raised suspicions on Substack that Means, a former food and drug lobbyist, and his younger sister Casey, a medical residency dropout who is now Donald Trump's nominee for U.S. Surgeon General, were industry plants sent to shift focus from vaccine safety to the more palatable concept of food as medicine. But she had since reversed course, writing that, upon closer examination, their mission appears rooted in personal conviction, shaped by profound loss, educational disillusionment, and a shared determination to transform healthcare. Now, as Krause directed Means to pose for a Polaroid, They discussed the evening's festivities and promised to keep in touch. Everyone thinks they're her best friend, Denise Beauvais, a photographer for Krauss's Substack, told me after the press conference, as the three of us sipped drinks at the Willard Hotel's bar. Krauss and Beauvais, who looked and act like sisters, met more than a decade ago, when they were both young mothers in Southern California. When Krauss decided to hit the campaign trail, she invited Beauvais to come along, both for the company. When you're on the road for a year, it could be depressing, and because she envisioned coverage that looked like Tina Brown's Vanity Fair. I wanted everything to look cool and pretty, Krauss said. What I think is cool, she thinks is cool. Now the pair reapplied their lip gloss and checked their phones. Where is the party tonight? Krauss dictated into her texting app. Krauss now noted that her Instagram stories, which she says can generate more than 100 million monthly views, were being reposted by Heinz. Congratulations, Maha Army. We did it, Krauss had written in one that day. Last September, when news broke that another friend of Krauss's, the journalist Olivia Nozzi, had exchanged intimate texts with Kennedy, Krauss wrote a Substack post accusing Nozzi of ensnaring Kennedy and insulted her looks on Instagram. I was so mean to her, Krauss told me. The pair remain friends, and Nozzi has visited Krauss at her home in San Clemente. I asked Krauss how she could still be friendly with both Kennedy's wife and the woman with whom he'd had a digital affair. I think it all comes back to trust, Krauss said. I mean, obviously, I know a lot about a lot of these things, but I'm not out to ruin anyone for fun. As the sun went down and the bar filled up, Krauss and Beauvais returned to their rooms to nap before the next event, a Maha action dinner at a downtown DC steakhouse. In the restaurant's dimly lit private dining room, I spotted Big Tree, Means, and Kennedy's former campaign chief of staff, Bridget Rasmussen. Krauss and Beauvais showed up late with Sean Spicer, Trump's first press secretary. Ice-filled seafood platters landed on the tables. Krauss ordered a martini with olives and got a download of the confirmation hearing from Rasmussen, who had been in the Senate gallery that day. They didn't let us have our phones in there, she said. No purse, chapstick, nothing. Krauss seemed incredulous. No chapstick? Dinner talk turned to TV makeup and Palm Beach beauty standards. You'd better be skinny with fillers and a spray tan, Krauss said, and eventually settled on childhood vaccinations. The mothers at the table, Krauss, Beauvais, and Jessica Perno, a Texas-based compliance officer who's been involved with Maha Action, were all alarmed about newborns receiving hepatitis B inoculations. Why are we vaccinating them as babies? Krauss, who had four sons, said. Her oldest son had been inoculated on schedule, but she had waited with her other children. I didn't do Hayes until he was 5 years old, she said. Mothers with the hepatitis B virus can pass it on to their children during birth. Big Tree stood and offered a toast. Robert Kennedy Jr. is HHS secretary, he said. It's one of the most epic, disrupting moments in political history, and certainly in the history of this country. He thanked the assembled group, singling out Means, who he said deserved credit for reaching out and bringing in the food issue, which was such a great cover to get Bobby all the way through. The room erupted with guffaws. Later, Spicer told me, all due respect, but if it were my event, I would have been like, what the fuck are you doing bringing a reporter to dinner? But Krauss is determinedly unfiltered, dedicated to giving her readers, many of whom are mothers, a behind-the-scenes view of Kennedy's world and of the space that she occupies within it. Her own contribution to mainstreaming her message, she told me, shouldn't be underestimated. I don't think he gets what I've really done for him. Krauss is not a health freak, nor is she a dogmatic conservative. She's pro-choice and supports gay rights, but she also embraces many of Trump's immigration policies. She rejects both established vaccine science and the mainstream media's treatment of shifting gender dynamics. Her writing delves into all these issues, but she is most interested in gossip and what she calls quality conspiracy. "My goal is to simplify everything," she told me. "I don't have a political audience. I'm not writing for Washington, D.C." Krauss grew up in Corona, California, the third of four kids. In the winter of 1986, her father, a heavy equipment operator, killed himself. Krauss, who was 6 years old, says that she didn't speak to anyone outside of the family for a year after his death, a condition doctors diagnosed as elective mutism. She spent much of her childhood in therapy and was, in her words, a funny, neurotic, and precocious child well-liked by teachers. She was also obsessed with pop culture and loved to write. Her mother, who had worked as a waitress but stayed at home after her husband's death, encouraged her interests. "She would take me to poetry readings, concerts, movies, no censorship," Krauss told me. "And here I am." Krauss met her husband, Mike, when they were still in high school. He was in a band. Their first date was to a guitar center in Hollywood. "He looked like a bleached Bob Dylan," she later wrote in a Valentine's Day post on Instagram. After high school, Mike got a union construction job and Krauss enrolled at Cal State Fullerton, where she majored in English. At 25, Krauss was working at a Starbucks and had just been accepted to a teaching certification program when she found out that she was pregnant. Her first son, Arlo, was born in 2005. Her second pregnancy ended in a late-term miscarriage, and she spent her third on bed rest, scrolling through TMZ and on an online forum for women dealing with the fallout from pregnancy loss. The forum, she has written, saved my sanity by giving me a place to empty my thoughts where I knew they would be nourished. In 2011, Krauss joined Instagram and started a blog spot, writing under the name Mrs. Habit. She posted photos of Mike, their sons, and their home, a modest Spanish-style bungalow in Corona. There were kiddie pools in the yard and a vintage VW buses in the driveway. The children, often barefoot, had long hair and skateboarded or showed off their art. Surely there are toilets to clean, bills to pay, kids to rinse, chores to cross off, and a little bit of party planning begging for my attention this bleak, boorish Friday afternoon, Krauss wrote in a post from 2011. But mama, she ain't hearing any of it. Elsewhere online, wellness culture was exploding. Goop, Gwyneth Paltrow's email newsletter turned e-commerce platform, monetized an all-natural lifestyle, promoting raw goat milk cleanses and expensive organic cosmetics. Paltrow recently told Vanity Fair that she was very fascinated by the MAHA movement. Jessica Alba founded her line of honest organic baby products in 2012. A sage-scented influencer ecosystem took hold, epitomized by the likes of Amanda Chantel Bacon, the creator of Moon Juice, and the smoothie bowl queen Lee Tiggleman, in which mostly left-leaning women with beautiful homes, flexible work schedules, and steadfast yoga practices rejected the conventional wisdom of a condescending, male-dominated medical establishment. Krauss focused mostly on family and interior design, but she mimicked both the aesthetic and the politics of wellness Instagram. When Hillary Clinton lost the 2016 presidential election, Krauss posted a black and white selfie with the caption, "Thank you at Hillary Clinton for fighting so hard for so long to lead us this far." During Trump's first inauguration, Krauss flew to D.C. to take part in the Women's March. That year, she and her husband bought a low-slung ranch home in San Clemente, an upscale beach town in Orange County, and renovated it themselves. Krauss documented the process online. The result? A gleaming white minimalist interior that Krauss said was inspired by Leonard Cohen's home on the Greek island of Hydra, garnered coverage in design blogs. She partnered with Samsung and the clothing brand Doan, whose flowing dresses she often wore in her photos. Krauss told me that it was a personal decision to widen her focus beyond motherhood. At a certain point, the kids were getting older, and they're aware they have their own issues, she said. I don't want to ever interfere with their confidence by how I present them online. Offline, Krauss was experiencing her first misgivings about liberal orthodoxy. During the 2018 Supreme Court confirmation hearings for Brett Kavanaugh, in which Christine Blasey Ford accused him of sexually assaulting her 4 decades earlier, Krauss wrote that she tried to speak with a friend about her discomfort with the believe all women ethos. She had known girls in high school who had lied about assaults, Krauss said. As a mother of 4 sons, she worried about the possibility that they could be falsely accused. Why can't it be listen to all women? She asked. The friend reacted poorly. Eventually, she stopped calling altogether, Krauss wrote. Space for conversation I knew was shrinking. Krauss was primed for a political shift when COVID hit. I'd watch live news and I'd see how they would take Trump's clips out of context, she said. I was really forced to confront what I trusted because I could see the spin happening in real time. California beaches were closed, skate parks were filled with sand. They came and bulldozed the bike jumps my boys built in. Like a secret field, Krauss said. We couldn't hike where we would normally hike. Orange County, one of the more conservative parts of the California coast, became a hotbed of lockdown protests. In San Clemente, crowds gathered to burn face masks. Krauss, who told me that she thought masks were insane, had started to read about natural immunity and was alarmed to learn that certain doctors were being censored. She ultimately chose not to vaccinate her children against COVID, a decision that angered her mother, with whom Krauss and 2 of her siblings no longer speak. I think she couldn't understand why we wouldn't just get the shot, Krauss said. I mean, of course, it's more complicated than that, but that's kind of what triggered the last fight. Krauss's mother said their falling out was more personal. I wasn't being treated right. Krauss was still maintaining a liberal facade online. When protests erupted after the death of George Floyd in the spring of 2020, she captioned a video of Tracy Chapman singing Fast Car with a riff about getting comfortable with being uncomfortable. Her husband, meanwhile, was adopting increasingly right-wing views. Later that summer, she discovered that he had left 4 clapping hand emojis on a transphobic post by the conservative pundit Candace Owens. Krauss was apoplectic. The fight, she wrote, ended with me out front in a bathrobe yelling like a madwoman as he almost laughed his way to his truck. When I lose all of my jobs, we know who to blame, I shouted as he started to drive away. Krauss's prediction came true. That fall, another influencer reposted Mike's comment. Krauss lost thousands of followers along with brand deals and gifted dresses in the mail. To amuse herself, she started posting about the sordid tabloid narratives of figures such as John F. Kennedy Jr., Monica Lewinsky, and Prince Harry's ex-girlfriend, Chelsea Davy. It was a radical departure from the chic, clean-surface content she had been sharing for years. I was like, I don't care anymore what the internet thinks, Krauss said. I just kept losing followers. I thought I was crashing, but I was having so much fun. Late this spring, I traveled to Laguna Beach to see Krauss. It was chilly and overcast, but bougainvillea were blooming, the locals were tan, and preteen boys were playing hacky sack in the street, nature and mankind performing a live-action tableau of California well-being. Krauss's office is in a rust-red, 2-story retail building a stone's throw from the beach. A large American flag flew from the porch railing, and House in Habit was painted in large white letters above the brand slogan, which Krauss adopted a few years ago, Media for the People, by the People. When I walked in, Krauss and her niece, Alicia Tang, who works as her assistant, were discussing ads that needed to be posted, one for headphones and another for a holistic food app. The office was light-filled and airy, with a wooden swing dangling from the ceiling. 2 big screen TVs played Fox News, and large racks filled with vintage issues of Life and Esquire lined one of the walls. By the entryway, Krauss had hung Julian Wasser's portrait of Joan Didion smoking a cigarette beside a Corvette. In the bathroom, near a tissue box adorned with a shirtless picture of RFK Jr., there was a framed excerpt from Didion's essay, Self-Respect. Krauss sat at a pale wood desk, a lit candle and a black crystal not far from her reach. Her eyes were obscured behind dark green sunglasses, and she occasionally sipped a saffron latte. As we spoke, her fingers never left her phone. At one point, she took a call from Nicholas Tartaglioni, Jeffrey Epstein's former cellmate at the Metropolitan Correctional Center in Manhattan. She has written multiple posts about Tartaglioni, a former cop turned drug dealer who was convicted of kidnapping and murdering four men, posting that he was framed. He is now seeking a presidential pardon, an effort that did not appear to be going well. Trump is known as the pardon president, Krauss said, soothingly into the phone. After a few minutes, she said goodbye. Later, I asked her how many inmates she was talking to for various stories. She thought for a moment, four? The top cities for House inhabit followers are San Diego, Los Angeles, Houston, and New York, making its audience a highly desirable demographic for advertisers. Women who are of prime consumer age, Krauss told me. These are the women who shop. House Inhabit's website sells t-shirts, hoodies, and other merchandise with slogans such as Drill Baby Drill and Orwell Warned Us. Tang later told me that advertising brings in an average of $20,000 per month, and Krauss said that her annual revenue from Substack subscribers is more than $1 million. There's things that cater and appeal to them, right? Krauss said of her readers, gossip and conspiracies. She's made a point of delivering both of those things. Krauss, an early member of the hashtag Free Britney movement, was in a Los Angeles courtroom in June of 2021 when Spears called in to ask to be released from her conservatorship. Krauss described the scene in her Instagram stories, adding her own Venmo information to her profile to solicit donations, a way for her followers to help Krauss stay on the story. She made more than $20,000 in a day. I realized there was money in doing it, she told me. Later that year, when Ghislaine Maxwell, Epstein's former girlfriend, went on trial in Manhattan for sex trafficking, Krauss flew to New York. Mike's like, oh, you should just go. I'll watch the kids, Krauss said. She got to the courtroom each day around 4 a.m. to secure a spot inside. Maxwell, a former British socialite who had been accused of procuring and grooming underage girls for Epstein's abuse, fascinated Krauss. In Instagram stories, she unspooled the life of Maxwell's father, a media magnate whose untimely death on a yacht in 1991 had aroused suspicions of foul play, and concluded that Maxwell was unjustly taking the fall for Epstein. That was the case that taught me how I was going to approach the role of an independent journalist, Krauss told me. I've been harassed endlessly over saying that she's a scapegoat and that I don't think her trial was fair. One friend admonished Krauss for writing too much about Maxwell's hair and appearance, but her sympathetic coverage got clicks. She gained 100,000 followers in the first 2 weeks of the trial. Krauss later developed some sources on the case, interviewing anonymous victims and traveling to Maxwell's old haunts and homes. The bailiffs would come up to me and be like, oh, my wife's following you, she said. It made trial coverage cool again. The journalist Vicky Ward, whom Krauss befriended during the Maxwell trial, told me that one of Krauss's strengths is that she's a completely free spirit and not beholden to anyone. In Laguna Beach, I asked why Krauss seemed attracted to controversial people. They're so amusing, she told me. I think it's funny. I want to be amused. Afterward, in a Substack post, she returned to my question, saying she'd given me the answer that she thought would look good in print. The truth is, she wrote, I've always been drawn to the defiant and the disgraced women who shape culture, only to be entirely devoured by it. Tabloid obsessions with complicated backstories are always the most alluring subjects. Krauss's real breakthrough came in the spring of 2022 when she began covering Johnny Depp's lawsuit against his ex-wife, Amber Heard. Depp had sued Heard for defamation after she recounted in a Washington Post opinion piece the reprisals she'd faced for speaking publicly about an abusive relationship, claiming the piece was unmistakably about him. The trial, which was televised, revealed details about the two stars' sex lives, drug use, and competing allegations of domestic abuse. Krauss leaned towards Depp's side of the story, writing that his addictions, vices, and ugly text messages are not what's on trial here. She became friendly with his legal team. During the proceedings, she received a surprise phone call from Depp. As she later recalled on Substack, Depp told her, "I don't know you, but I know, just by the words you use and the aesthetic in your work, that I trust you." Krauss was hardly alone in her anti-Heard stance. On social media, the actress was often painted as a liar and a loose cannon. The intensity of the vitriol directed against her seemed like a backlash to the hashtag MeToo movement's admonitions to believe all women. "My commentary matched what most people were thinking," Krauss told me. "I just don't think she was likable to the public. It was a very toxic relationship, but he shouldn't have his career ruined when they're guilty of the same thing." The following year, Krauss recalled Courtney Love, whom she had met during the Depp trial, told her that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was planning to announce a run for the president. A representative for Love said this was inaccurate. "She's friends with his daughter," Krauss said of Love. "She always knows what's happening before it's happening." Kennedy, who during the pandemic had been deplatformed for spreading misinformation about vaccines on social media, was a classic Krauss character, a punchline in elite circles who had become a prophet in conspiracy-minded corners of the internet. Krauss was immediately intrigued. I was like, "Oh, that's the guy that my friends all liked during COVID." In April of 2023, when Trump was indicted in Manhattan for falsifying business records in connection to hush money payments to the former adult film star Stormy Daniels, Krauss traveled to New York City. I'm like, I should cover politics because it's going to be crazy if a Kennedy's running and we have Trump, she said. I was going to apply the same formula that worked for these trials to politics. That June, Krauss posted an old photo of Kennedy standing in front of his family's Cape Cod compound holding an owl. "Someone's working hard for my vote," she wrote, adding an owl emoji. "During the Maxwell trial," she told me, "I started reading about owls, and it was like a sign of intuition and following your intuition." The post got more than 19,000 likes. Kennedy himself reached out. "Nobody liked him at this point," Krauss said. "He was so happy." Kennedy's team invited her to his home in Los Angeles. Krauss, who has a photo album on her phone devoted to what she calls shirtless Kennedy showing off toned torsos in various boating scenes around Cape Cod, was starstruck. But she soon realized that the purpose of the meeting was to get her to film an endorsement video. When she resisted, Kennedy grew annoyed and scolded his campaign staff. He's like, "I thought you said she knew what she was doing," Krauss recalled. And they're like, "She does know what she's doing. This isn't what she does." Finally, Kennedy asked about her audience. Did they like his wife? He's like, "Cheryl, Cheryl," walking around the house, Krauss said. And I'm like, this guy is really weird. I don't like him. A spokesperson for Kennedy did not respond to a request for comment. But the campaign kept inviting her to events. I'm like, okay, I'll just go on the road and I'll follow him for now because he's the only one offering access, Krauss said. And then that was popular right away. A photo of Krauss and Kennedy got 42,000 Instagram likes, and her three-part Substack recap of their first few meetings received hundreds of comments. "Literally silent screamings for you right now," one reader wrote. In November, Krauss was a guest at the Kennedy compound on Cape Cod, along with Mike and their 9-year-old son, Hayes. It's all of a sudden I woke up one day and said, I'm doing politics. And then I was on the road. Kraus said, I just never came home. You're listening to The New Yorker Magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Tang, her assistant, estimated that Kraus had taken 50 trips in the past year. Kraus's campaign coverage was, in many ways, one long party report. In 2024, she spent New Year's in Aspen with the Kennedy family. That January, she was in Hawaii, where Bobby photographed the candidate and his son, Finn, posing playfully underwater. He's very likable, Kraus said of Kennedy. He's 71, but he can seem very young and like he's seeing the world through young eyes. She grew close to the campaign staff, and her posts became more adulatory. After joining Kennedy for a San Diego sailboat outing, which she called poetically endearing, she wrote, of all his appearances, it's events like these that serve as a scenic metaphor for Kennedy's vision, turning the tide on current politics, shifting the course away from corporate greed, and hoping people will vote out of hope, not fear. The Trump campaign began to notice that Kraus's posts offered a way to charm a certain kind of swing voter. In February, 9 months before the election, she and Bobby were invited to Mar-a-Lago. They stayed in the Tower Suite and attended Trump's Super Bowl watch party, a private event where Kraus archly observed that what she called MAGA's dedication to beauty. I'm an aesthetic snob, she told me. I think Republicans need a lot of help with their image. But Kraus increasingly agreed with their politics. She started posting more often about the Trumps, publishing text messages from Don Jr. that refuted claims that Trump had never attended his children's graduations. That May, she made a pilgrimage to Trump's childhood home in Queens with Nuzzi as her guide. Kraus's coverage unlocked a new level of access. Previously, she and her family had met Tulsi Gabbard, who has since become Trump's director of national intelligence, for Asahi Bowls on the north shore of Oahu. Now Kraus was visiting the former Disney CEO Michael Eisner's property in Malibu and Lachlan Murdoch's home in Beverly Hills. He was so nice, Kraus said of Murdoch. It was like some event and it was off record, so I couldn't say I was there. Kraus and Bobby often tag team parties. People trusted us together, Bobby said. I was a fly on the wall. I would just snap pictures of who we were talking to and what we were doing. Kraus would discreetly take notes on her phone. People, for the most part, they just forgot. They didn't think of me as media, she said. So I got away with a lot. I realized what I was at a lot of events where media wasn't allowed. For months, pundits had debated whether Kennedy's campaign would spoil things for the Democrats or for the Republicans. Kennedy himself had found his way to anti-vaccine activism through his work as an environmentalist, advocating to keep water clean from mercury and other pollutants. But by August, when Kennedy dropped out, it had become clear that vaccine skepticism was a more comfortable fit within the Trump coalition. The Kennedy campaign's website had sold Make Frying Oil Tallow Again hats, a reference to the movement to avoid supposedly toxic seed oils, canola, corn, sunflower, commonly used in American cooking. Now green hats bearing the MAHA logo were rolled out. Kraus made no secret of her affinity for Trump. When Kennedy endorsed him, Kraus posted a picture of the pair with a caption, Trump Kennedy equals unity. You know I fought hard for this. Kraus began posting photos of herself with Don Jr. and his family. She'd gone shopping with his girlfriend, Bettina Anderson, and publishing substacks with titles like Women Across America Just Fell in Love with J.D. Vance. Her coverage of MAGA flotilla in Florida included an interview with one of Trump's grandchildren. Everyone is so beautiful, one commenter wrote. Looks like a Ralph Lauren ad. Kraus was often vague about the policy implications of another Trump presidency, but her post made clear that she thought the MAGA crowd was fun at a party. A lot of people think that I made Kennedy supporters comfortable with his alignment with Trump, she told me. By election day, she was firmly entrenched in Trump's world. This past New Year's, as Trump was preparing to return to the White House, Krauss attended a party at the home of the billionaire right-wing tech investor Peter Thiel. The Miami power gays are something else, she wrote in a text to her 9-year-old son. We're eating lobster on a boat while a man hovers over the water with sparks flying from his boots. Fireworks at midnight. I'll send you photos later. In late February, Krauss was invited to the White House, along with 14 other right-wing influencers, including Mike Cernovich and Chaya Raichik of Libs of TikTok, to receive a binder from the Justice Department labeled the Epstein Files Phase 1. Krauss was photographed walking out of the meeting wearing a checkered suit and a hat that read, Trump was right about everything. The event was seen as a case of the administration mainstreaming fringe conspiracy theorists. But it soon became apparent that the binders contained little new information about the Epstein case. I think it was a stunt gone wrong, Krauss said, noting that she considered only a few of the invitees, herself included, to be experts on the Epstein case. Some of these online conspiracy theorists constantly need to spin everything into something that's more exciting. For the record, Krauss thinks that Epstein died by suicide. Since Kennedy's confirmation party, her friendship with Bobby had unraveled following a fight at a dinner event. The night of our big falling out, my daughter and colleagues were there and she had an outburst, Bobby told me, declining to go into further detail. And I just said, I'm never speaking to you again. Krauss later posted an angry Substack chat, which she has since deleted, claiming that Bobby had driven Krauss's son in a car with someone drunk. Bobby replied with an emotional Instagram video. I love her family and we're very close, Bobby said, crying. I'm just a regular person. I've made mistakes. But to have someone you've given years to and have shared intimate things, we were best friends. After the DOJ distributed its Epstein binders, The Bulwark, a Never Trump news site, released a podcast episode that mocked Krauss's White House appearance. She wrote a scathing response on Substack. I was in a very vulnerable space, she told me. Part of what I do is not overthink everything, so I will write whatever I've been feeling that week. Her post accused the podcast of minimizing her work. My Instagram story slides pull 200 to 300 million views monthly, she wrote, numbers that dwarf most network news broadcasts. She also claimed that the podcast targeted her as a woman. God forbid that they let a mother slash lifestyle blogger into the elite corners of the presidential press pool to relay information to the masses, she wrote. She lashed out at the more established right-wing figures. Tucker Carlson was hard to take seriously these days, and Megyn Kelly and Candace Owens, two of the most prominent women in male-dominated media, are clearly pivoting, she added. Both are leaning into narratives that resonate with women. Celebrity scandals, political gossip, interpersonal drama. Krauss's tone sounded territorial. Owens, who was then devoting much of her airtime to the legal drama between Blake Lively and Justin Baldoni, responded to Krauss on Instagram. Her argument is that everyone is trying to just be her, Owens wrote. It's a lot to take in. Krauss, who was in D.C., fired back. I'm at the White House. I'll respond when I'm not shadowing the president. LOL, thank you. The pair went back and forth in story and live format until Owens brought up the recent disintegration of Krauss's relationship with Bobby. Krauss said that the feud with Owens had made me look at all these people differently. It's like its own media, but it's not media I really trust. Owens told me no one ever knows what she is talking about. Jessica Reed Krauss is unwell. This summer, when the Trump administration abruptly declared that no further disclosure would be appropriate or warranted in the Epstein case, the story became a fixture of the mainstream press. Flight records show that Trump flew on Epstein's private plane, which was nicknamed the Lolita Express. Kennedy has said that he too flew on Epstein's jet. Krauss felt that her contribution to the coverage, a deeper theory as to why Maxwell was used as a scapegoat, with plenty of speculation about the past actions of Bill Clinton, weren't being sufficiently recognized. What I've uncovered as exclusives have been completely ignored by the media, she said. It is hurtful to get miscast as a hack. Recently, a fellow Substacker, Michael Tracy, accused Krauss of plagiarizing his work in a couple of her Epstein posts, one of which was subsequently removed. In a newsletter, Krauss apologized, saying that she had made an honest but careless mistake in one instance, but denied that she had done so in another. More broadly, Krauss was feeling really sort of depressed with the public, she told me. I don't think they like to read anymore. They want really short videos that are going to shock them. Even her most devoted readers seem to have unrealistic expectations. People, especially in my audience, really crave conspiracy, she said. So when you give them a more boring version of it, they tend to turn on you. Krauss had posted a photograph of herself with Trump, Vance, and Kennedy in the Oval Office. A commenter wrote, I don't understand how you can support these men, especially when two of them were on Epstein's plane. After everything you taught us about Epstein, is that just thrown to this side now? I'm so confused. Krauss's popularity had stemmed from her beginnings making lifestyle content for middle-aged moms with cash to burn. Much of the creator economy, which Goldman Sachs estimates is worth around $250 billion, is dominated by women selling images of upscale motherhood. Krauss had moved from messy boys and clean California interiors to opulent parties, posh hotels, and various DC hearing rooms, but her coverage still attracted large audiences of women. I found you while trying to figure out where Princess Kate was, one commenter recently wrote. But stay because you opened my eyes to what was going on with our government, health, and politics. Another was less generous. Man, this is all going to be fascinating to look back on in a couple of years when you realize how much you were used and bamboozled. Krauss has taken issue with the current administration. She wrote a tariff debate for dummies post to walk readers through Trump's trade war, but she told me, I want to believe he knows what he's doing, but I think it's really risky. She liked the president's immigration policies, but not the White House's ASMR parody video of men being deported to a Salvadoran prison or of the posting of an AI-generated vision of a Trump-run Gaza. I don't like tacky things, Krauss said. Her opinion of Kennedy, too, she told me, had changed over time. Kennedy has fired 10,000 HHS employees, canceled $500 million in mRNA research, the technology that allowed for the rapid development of a COVID vaccine, and replaced the health experts on the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Vaccine Advisory Panel with 7 new advisors, most of whom are vaccine skeptics. In August, after the agency's head reportedly refused to accept the panel's new restrictions on certain vaccines, Kennedy moved to fire her. Three other leaders at the agency resigned in protest. The CDC no longer recommends the COVID vaccine for pregnant women who are at a higher risk of severe illness, and the FDA, in approving the latest shot, authorized its use only for people who are over the age of 65 or suffering from underlying conditions. I think overall, in 5 months, he's done an incredible job, Krauss said of Kennedy. I think he's gotten more done than any health secretary in the past. But Krauss's view of him hadn't been affected by his policies. It was more layered, she said. Right now, I've gotten pretty close to the center of it all, and I'm just trying to figure out what I think about politicians in general. She didn't really feel a part of any movement, MAHA or otherwise, she said. I just write what I like. Her motivation, she told me, had always been, this is a good story, he's a good subject. This is an interesting time in politics, and he's letting me be part of it in a very intimate way. And that's all I cared about. I pressed further. Had her opinion of Kennedy been changed because of his personal actions? No comment, Krauss said. Claire Malone is a staff writer at The New Yorker covering the media business, journalism, and politics. She received the 2025 Mirror Award for commentary. The lead: what the video of Charlie Kirk's murder might do. Parents have less and less control over what their children see. Our children will likely understand history and the world very differently as a result. By J. Caspian Kang. How many of your children saw the assassination of Charlie Kirk on their phones? Did they seek it out, or did it just roll in unannounced on their feeds? If they had never heard of Kirk before they watched his gruesome murder, how did they make sense of what they saw? Did the horrific image, I won't describe it because you have probably already seen it, sear itself into their memories? I ask because I have two young children and spend most of my time around other parents. In the days after the videos of Kirk's death spread across the social media, I realized that most children with phones, as far as I could tell, had viewed at least one unedited version. This was likely not the first disturbing video these children had encountered, of course, nor the first act of political violence that had appeared on their feeds. These same children, who are mostly between the ages of 11 and 18, saw the president's bleeding ear and dozens, maybe even hundreds, of images of unfathomable trauma in Gaza. How will these already infamous scenes fall into order in their minds and coalesce into something resembling history? Widely dispersed photos and video, the stuff we all see, are the closest thing we have to a collective, democratized history. But the connections between memories and their associated images wear thin and become increasingly unreliable. For baby boomers, those images include people standing and pointing in the direction of gunshots at a motel in Memphis, Kennedy's exploding head, the documentary footage of crowds at Woodstock, the girl in the picture in Vietnam, the bodies at Jonestown, and so forth. As boomers have aged, those images have become a bit unmoored from their place in time and more evocative of a feeling of rebellion and change or whatever. I'm sure many members of the generation would tell you that they watched Kennedy get shot live on television and would describe the terrible movement of his head without realizing that what they were describing was from the Zapruder film, which first aired to the public in 1975, more than a decade after Kennedy's motorcade drove through Dealey Plaza. Maybe they will also tell you that they saw the photos of the My Lai massacre, and that they very well may have, but perhaps the image they are recalling is that of the naked girl running from a napalm attack in Trung Bang. My generation, I am 45 years old, seemingly grew up with far fewer public images of violence. One of the texts I've grappled with and referenced before in my column is Jean Baldred's The Gulf War Did Not Take Place, which argues that Operation Desert Storm was a conflict designed specifically for a new media landscape in which most people would be following the war on cable news. Americans watch Patriot missiles light up the night sky, but in contrast to those watching TV during the war in Vietnam, we did not see casualties or much destruction, nor did we tune in every night to hear a litany of the names of dead servicemen. Until 9/11, the violence that we did see on TV was mostly poor quality and from a distance. The shaky shots of the burning Branch Davidian compound in Waco, the remains of the federal building in Oklahoma City. One notable exception was the images of starving children during the 1983-85 famine in Ethiopia, which inspired a worldwide effort marked by the release of the charity single, We Are the World. So here's a series of questions. If exposures to images of violence changes a generation of children, how are boomers different from my generation? And how will my own children, will be exposed to far more evidence of political violence than I have been, be different from me? Is the effect of seeing carefully selected images of violence through the evening news or newspapers different from that caused by the chaos of violent images children see today through their phones? If we agree that history is formed through these images, What does history look like when there are thousands of different choices, camera angles, interpretations, and even fakes? How would we understand the massacre at Kent State if it happened today? What would it look like? What happens when, rather than all of us seeing an image of a young woman in the throes of shock and mourning kneeling over a dead body, we see hundreds of cell phone videos that capture the terror as it unfolds real time? I don't have any satisfying answers to these questions, nor do I have a particularly strong opinion on whether children should see these scenes or not. There have been years of studies on the effects that violence on television and in video games has on young minds, and some authors have suggested that they desensitize children and might even lead to copycat acts. I have always been a bit skeptical of these claims, and particularly of the way that they are invoked during that emotional period after a tragedy has taken place, when people are looking around for someone or something to blame. And of course, such studies do not fully explain why some kids can watch gore or play violent video games without any problems, and other kids allegedly turn into killers because of them. In the past, panic over violence in various forms of media, hip-hop, video games, movies, has largely concerned works of fiction. The worry wasn't that the real world was as violent as Grand Theft Auto and that children should be protected from the truth, but rather that Grand Theft Auto would be recreated in the real world. Today, children will see acts of actual violence that are indistinguishable from what they might see in movies or video games. Both will take place on the same tiny screens. Oftentimes, they will appear back to back. Thanks to the democratization of content creation and the incursion of AI tools, there will be an untold volume of gore that's well beyond the regulations and rating systems that govern Hollywood and the gaming industry. What happens to these scenes of real political violence when they get sunk into a sea of slop? How fully might those lines blur? For the past two decades, some of the work of figuring out what kids should and shouldn't watch has been relegated to Common Sense Media, a nonprofit that provides in-depth ratings for video games, movies, and television shows with the goal of putting kids' safety and well-being first in the digital era. At its inception back in the early 2000s, the group mostly focused on violent video games and movies, but it has pivoted in recent years towards addressing the fire hose of content, much of it violent and real, that has taken over children's screens. Jill Murphy, the organization's chief content officer, told me that, at young ages, children probably do not have the ability to distinguish between what's real and what's not. But as they grow older and can make those distinctions, footage of real violence tends to have a stronger and much more harmful developmental impact on children because it feels so immediate and it feels so personal, and they know that it's true and can be true and can apply potentially to their own personal lives. She and her organization understand that it's difficult for parents to police everything their children see on their screens. You can make sure your kid does not have a phone, but once they go to school, one of their friends will, and they will be sharing a potentially traumatizing video with anyone who will watch. Murphy's own daughter, for example, saw the footage of Kirk's assassination because a kid who sat next to her in class was watching it. As a result, Common Sense Media argues that there should be robust age verification regulations put on social media companies to make sure that children are not being inundated with lurid content at all hours of the day. Still, even if we assume that watching violence on a screen does produce a host of bad psychological effects, we should also ask if there's a cost to not witnessing violence when it happens, and to sanitizing an unstable and precarious world. It seems like most 15-year-olds in America today have seen decapitated babies and starving children in Gaza. They have seen the bloody aftermath of a music festival held on October 7th. Before that, they watched George Floyd slowly lose consciousness and die with a police officer's knee on his neck. They saw a police precinct in Minneapolis set ablaze in response. And now they have seen an assassination from a few hundred feet away. at several different angles. Their parents, at their age, could not have imagined this vocabulary of violence or this grisly list of visual references. I asked Murphy if she thought that restricting real-world footage might dull the reality of violence and the risk recreating, in a way, the obviously jingoistic terms of Desert Storm. We as adults have a responsibility to our children to create an environment where they can move through challenges at a pace that feels manageable, she replied. All children, she added, would have to deal with the realities of a violent world at some point, but there was something excessive and chaotic about the full access children now have to every act of political violence and bombing that is taking place around the world. I certainly agree that there is some age at which children should be protected from seeing these things, but I don't know what that age is. My daughter is 8 years old, and I don't think she has seen the video of Kirk's death, although who can really be sure these days? While driving her around this past week, I have felt a powerful urge to preserve this innocence, despite understanding that futility and even the sentimentality of such silly nostalgia for my own cloistered childhood. As long as the majority of kids above the age of 12 have internet access and a screen in their pockets, they're going to watch far more snuff films than anyone else in the history of the world. And as long as those videos are posted within seconds of the act, there will probably be no meaningful way to stop them from being shared. These children, as a result, may have a much clearer idea of what happens when one of those missiles, which looked almost beautiful, white trails of smoke against a black sky, actually hits its target. Death and trauma of all types will not be as abstract for them as they were for us. Will our children resist violence more than we did, or will they fall into the nihilism of those who have seen too much history happen in their lifetimes? By Jay Caspian. Jay Kang. Jay Caspian Kang is a staff writer at The New Yorker and the author of The Loneliest Americans. We are at the conclusion of this week's The New Yorker magazine program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Thank you for tuning in this week, and I invite you to join me next week for another new edition of The New Yorker magazine. Have a great week and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.